a lot of the conditions that drive people to Bitcoin, a lot of the wrongs that they see in the world, aren't as pronounced in Japan, in a sense. It's harder to understand, you know, why Bitcoin matters as a Japanese person, especially if you haven't lived overseas.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. In this episode, I talk with Kishin Kato, a Japanese Bitcoiner working on various Lightning and Bitcoin education-focused projects and heavily involved with the Bitcoin community in Japan. We discuss some of the broad connections between Japan and New Zealand, including the state of agriculture, free trade, financial gatekeepers, as well as the emergence of different Bitcoin narratives. If you have any questions or would like to reach out, my emails are always open, hello@thetransformationofvalue.com. And if you want to support the show, please consider leaving a review or boosting some sats via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform. Otherwise, on to the show. Maybe we can start with a little bit about your background, Kishin, and sort of who you are, what you do, and then we can go from there. How's that sound?
All right, sure. I grew up here in Japan, in Nara, which is out in the countryside, and I went to college in the US, where during my time at college, I discovered Bitcoin, basically, initially as kind of a way to transfer money back and forth, because, you know, that's hella expensive, right? And then I started falling down the rabbit hole. And after college, I've been doing research, I've been doing translation, programming, like, you know, anything I can in this industry, basically, to stay involved. And so lately I've been working on a lot of Lightning Network stuff. I also work with Koji from Diamond Hands on a bunch of side projects, and, you know, I'm a well-rounded Bitcoiner is what I consider myself.
Yeah, no, we met a couple of weeks ago, or so late last year, and you shared some of the writing that you've been working on. Was it the CoinKen?
Yeah. It's called Bitcoin Kenkyujo, which is like Bitcoin Lab in English.
Yeah. And that's really cool. And kind of seeing that local breakdown of what's going on in the Bitcoin space and kind of disseminating that in Japanese, I think, is really important. And I had seen a lot of Koji's writing and some of his videos online, and sort of getting to know some of the Japanese Bitcoiners. And it's really an interesting space, because I don't know how you would describe it, but for me it seems like quite a tight-knit but maybe small community at the moment. How would you characterize it?
Yeah, it's definitely a very small community. It's not a lot of the conditions that drive people to Bitcoin, a lot of the wrongs that they see in the world, aren't as pronounced in Japan, in a sense. It's harder to understand, you know, why Bitcoin matters as a Japanese person, especially if you haven't lived overseas.
Yeah, I think that was sort of what I was saying to you before we started recording. You know, I've had this, I've got this opportunity to present Bitcoin as a concept to some friends and a group of people involved in permaculture and sort of, you know, more sustainable ways of farming and living, and kind of there's quite a lot of overlap, you know, things like circular economies, sustainability, that sort of thing. And I had to really go back and think, well, like, how do I even explain this in Japanese? You know, like, what is the narrative that we can kind of see and kind of present, and then talk to that? Obviously inflation is a big one in New Zealand and other places, but in Japan, I think it's perhaps not as pronounced. You sort of see this perhaps decline in quality of goods, but yeah, the price doesn't massively go up. Mm-hmm. And so people don't necessarily see that as much as they would in New Zealand when they go shopping and they think, man, what happened to my money? Mm-hmm. What sort of narratives or sort of ways of thinking about Bitcoin in a Japanese context have you kind of come to?
Inflation definitely isn't as persuasive in Japan, just like you pointed out. I mean, the last couple of years, it's been a lot more pronounced than it has been in the past. But yeah, that doesn't really resonate. The difficulty of getting a bank account doesn't really resonate. It's really hard to find the common talking points of the talking points that matter, I guess, to Japanese people, because a lot of the sailings of fiat that Bitcoiners talk about a lot don't really apply here. And it's really something I struggle with a lot. You do talk about Bitcoin with your friends or family if you think they won't judge you for it, right? And so I've usually gone the ethical route, I guess, just that there are a lot of things unfair about money, or perhaps I think one thing that is intuitive to everybody in a capitalist society is that competition makes products better for their users, and that fiat currency lacks the competition necessary to make it better, right? There's no pressure to be responsible about.
Well, it's quite esoteric, though, to sort of talk about innovating on money.
You know,
it's sort of, it's not something that people have maybe ever thought about before. So that can be a challenge. It's sort of, you've got to open that whole field before you can even start talking about it.
Money is a topic that makes people really uncomfortable.
I mean, I guess where I've arrived at for this particular presentation that I'll hopefully give in the next couple of weeks is the idea of the circular economy. And it's kind of a big theme within permaculture. And I think in a roundabout way, some of the themes that I'm seeing holistically emerging around people returning to their hometowns or trying to take a bit of a step away from the big cities in Japan, I'm seeing this kind of broader yearning or kind of desire for new ways of living come out. But Bitcoin's kind of at the bottom of that list. I think for most people, it's about maybe just having a better quality of life. And so actually interesting, we've just had the earthquake in Western Japan in Kanazawa, where I was a couple of weeks ago, and I really loved it out there. And there's actually quite a lot of communities, and unfortunately a lot of them were really heavily hit by the earthquake. But these kind of rural communities where they sort of want, you know, young families or foreigners or different people to come out and kind of repopulate these dying villages, you know, with remote work and things like that, you can have these new ways of living. And I think that's a topic that's maybe a lot more accessible for the mainstream in Japan. What are your thoughts on these kind of other decentralizing ideas that are around at the moment?
Yeah, the countryside's been trying to get people, younger people, people with families to come over for years now. And to some extent, you know, some people idolize the bucolic life, right? Some people make the leap, but it's inconvenient. It's a challenge. And it's also important to point out that it's not like everybody welcomes new blood to their community, right?
It's hard. I mean, I know from experience, even in New Zealand, it's hard to turn up and just locate yourself in the countryside. And Japan, you know, there's language barriers, there's whole lots of issues there. And even if you're a Tokyo Gen, you know, Tokyo person, and you kind of try and turn up, it doesn't really work all the time. But that said, there is a desire for that. Now, I see that. I see maybe people taking career changes, kind of trying to get away from this kind of a sort of tidal wave of fiat struggles that are kind of more and more weighing people down. And right now with the weak yen as well, it's even more pronounced. You know, you got people, you know, making whatever it is, working in a convenience store or a cafe or something, and you think, man, that's pretty harsh. You know, it's almost poverty wages. But there's something, the manipulation of the money is doesn't factor in that. It's sort of almost like, well, if I just work a bit harder, you know, the problem will go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a testament to maybe there's a very honorable way of approaching it, but it's also like a bit of a shame in a way that there's not an awareness that it's not your fault.
Yeah.
It's something bigger.
It's kind of, you know, they're being taken advantage of, sort of. But I think as a Bitcoiner, one thing that I struggle with is that, sure, I was raised in the countryside and I understand a lot of the appeal, especially the older I get, the more I appreciate the environment that I grew up in. But it's also true that a lot of the countryside is uncompetitive, subsidized, all of these things that aren't necessarily what Bitcoiners would support. A lot of the industry is government subsidized. A lot of it's not a very capitalistic place, the Japanese countryside. You need to get some key players to like you, basically, to get anything done. If you want to get a job, start a business, buy some farmland, all of these people that you need to know.
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. I think New Zealand and Japan have a lot of similarities that we can almost kind of break down. New Zealand is a very easy to do business kind of a place, and registering a company takes 15 minutes online. Anyone can have a bank account, anyone can start a company. This is a very open globalist exposure. But the New Zealand of effectively up until the 1980s was very similar to Japan. You had huge basically state-owned operations everywhere. There was a government department for everything, and it was a very socialist approach. And in sort of a period of a couple of years, there was this huge neoliberal reform that took place in the 1980s, and it very much sort of shook things up. And I would argue perhaps that, it was before my time, but the New Zealand of the 70s or the 60s, the rural New Zealand, maybe resembled rural Japan in many ways. You had to kind of get permission to do things. It was very uncompetitive. And this kind of free market basically was wrought and ripped. The old way of doing things was ripped out, and this kind of free market export orientation emerged. Many things were lost, but many things were gained. However, arguably, Japan's a much older country. There's a lot more historical kind of reasons for the way things are. And I haven't really got any solid conclusions or anything like that, but I know exactly what you're talking about, having sort of seen it myself, and trying to optimize that for productivity is, it's almost like that's not what it's trying to do.
Yeah.
Sort of like the capitalism comes second to maintaining a certain way of life, mm-hmm. a certain culture, would you say?
Yeah.
And that sort of way of doing things is actually in a way a benefit, though, and I think we're seeing that now, where it's sort of been the same for so long that as the rest of the world changes so rapidly and begins to kind of disintegrate in many ways, Japan is still just trucking along. Maybe its population is getting a bit older or whatnot, but I don't see the structural kind of cultural issues that certainly New Zealand's experiencing right now.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's kind of like Japan's locked in time. Japan used to be the bastion of low birth rate, and oh my goodness, this country is doomed. But now you look at every other East Asian country, they all have lower birth rates than Japan does, and so
pretty sure
weird.
I'm pretty sure most developed countries have the same issue.
Yeah,
but the way that Japan has done it and the way New Zealand has done it is very different. And for better or for worse, I think the Japanese approach has been to maintain a kernel of, I guess, Japanese-ness to the way they run things. Whereas New Zealand really took the lead of this kind of globalist neoliberal approach to opening up business, opening up immigration, opening up everything, and effectively going from a certain kind of mythological bicultural New Zealand into kind of the international place that it is now. And there are still pockets of New Zealand that have the old way of being. Certainly where I grew up was like that. However, I guess it's just a different model of running an economy. And I say that not fully in truth, I guess, because nobody really runs an economy. It's a thing that happens as individual actors do what they do. But I don't know. I think there's a lot we can learn from, you know, these two places. And I certainly think the island mentality, which is certainly in contrast to kind of a continental approach, you know, the social structure here in New Zealand, I think there are similarities. You know, it's very hard to burn a bridge in New Zealand. You know, you don't get very far if you do that.
Yeah, I think there are limits to how capitalistic and free you can be in a small community. You know, you're just gonna stir up a lot of trouble, right?
Well, that was a topic that I broached a couple of episodes ago, talking with G Sovereignty about, you know, this idea perhaps that a lot of, you know, generally speaking, Asian countries potentially may interface with Bitcoin at a very corporate or governmental level, but the individual consumer may not see it. Sort of like a bit like the gold standard. You know, you had, you know, Nippon Ginko, Mitsubishi Bank running, you know, some Bitcoin stuff, but the actual individual was still getting fiat paper. Mm-hmm. You know, what are your thoughts on that within Japan?
I don't know. I don't see what the killer app or like the key trigger for mass adoption in Japan would be yet. Honestly, I think the store of value narrative is probably the number one contender, but Japan has a pretty patronizing government, like a
paternal
government. Is that what you would say? Call it? Yeah. So it's gonna be decades, perhaps, before they want to like.
All right. I saw an ad on the subway for 0.5% interest rates on mm-hmm. some special bank account, SBI or something. And so that kind of gives you an idea of what you can get for a store of value. At the same time, you know, you've got, there's advanced financial institutions here, arguably too advanced and too big, where it's kind of hard to kind of be a contender and be a player. I think because a lot of the different Bitcoin and crypto exchanges have actually had a lot of trouble in Japan. Some of them have left, right?
Yeah, over the years, there have been a bunch of failures, yeah.
And so the sort of different people that I've spoken to, sort of friends of mine, interestingly enough, I would say one thing is that the general perception of Bitcoin isn't a straight out negative. You know, I don't know what it is, but in New Zealand, there's a very negative a tone about anything to do with Bitcoin. I think the FUD is deep. However, in Japan, I think it's more kind of, it's a investment. It's a way to invest, perhaps. It's an idea. You got places like DMM, and I think there's a couple of other players offering Bitcoin as a thing you can buy through their exchange. But, I mean, I was surprised that there was not negative, you know, I wasn't expecting much, but it wasn't a negative impression straight away. But of the people who I spoke to, everyone was using one of these centralized exchanges. Mm-hmm. And I tried to explain self-custody, and they didn't know what I was talking about. Mm. And so that was kind of my feeling, was that it's this speculative vehicle still, perhaps.
Yeah, I think the Japanese perception of Bitcoin is mostly one of two camps. One is the it's a gambling, it's a, you know, trading instrument, it's a forex, it's new forex, right? And I'm guessing those are the people who you spoke to, and that's actually the more benign camp. And the other half is, oh, it's a scam, right? And there is a reason, and it's mostly because a lot of scams compare themselves to Bitcoin. Like, they're just multi-layer marketing scams. You know, you go, you know, collect 1,000,000 yen and you'll get to keep 20% of it. And you know. But a lot of those take the form of, oh, you know, Bitcoin was big. Now this coin's going to be even bigger. And now go and find 10 people to invest.
Yeah, right? that was my feeling. So the people I spoke to, I think genuinely saw it as an investment vehicle. Mm-hmm. But I know exactly what you're talking about when it comes to the scam aspect. And I think this is almost perhaps a cultural thing, but a kind of, what would you call it, sagi, you know, kind of the culture, the scam concept. You know, like, for example, you know, in the convenience store. I saw, you know, with the Apple cards and the Amazon gift cards, there was this thing, and it was like something like Bitcash something. And it has nothing to do with Bitcoin. It's nothing to do with anything. It's literally just a kind of funny money. Yet it was able to call itself Bitcash. And anyone, you know, if you say something, hey, you know, have you got any Bitcoin? They say, yeah, I got some Bitcash. And I could see that sort of stuff happening. And I don't know, it's maybe lack of regulation. I don't know, maybe too much regulation, but that stuff just happens. And people get confused. And maybe, I mean, you guys are obviously doing a lot of great work trying to translate concepts over, but maybe there's not a cultural awareness. Because even in New Zealand, it's hard to even explain what Bitcoin is.
Yeah, the Bitcash thing is especially funny because I've only ever seen it used in scams.
Yeah.
Where, you know, somebody would, like, romance scams where, like, you know, I need you to send me $1,000 in Bitcash for a plane ticket or something like that.
Yeah, and I think that it's kind of challenging because one rotten apple kind of taints the whole thing. And I mean, it's same with shit coins and stuff as well, but you get one time, you know, you hear about someone who got scammed using this Bitcash thing, and then anything related to Bit whatever is suddenly off the table. And at the same time, though, I think coming back to some fundamentals, I mean, as you say, Japan's a relatively safe country, relatively prosperous in Asia. People kind of work hard and they try their best, but there isn't really sort of this pressing economic incentive that's like lighting a fire under people's asses and saying, hey, you need to try and look at something else. And I would say even the concept of foreign exchange is pretty marginal. Like, it's pretty common, and so I mean, I'd like to hear your opinion, but like for me, in New Zealand, it's pretty common to think about Australian dollars, US dollars as a concept, and to understand that there's this flow and that the New Zealand dollar is just one little piece of the global economy. But I think in a lot of cases, you know, when would, besides overseas travel, when would a normal Japanese person ever engage with any foreign currency? I don't know. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think Block did a study and something like 97% of Japanese people have never sent an international remittance.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
And I do believe that's strongly correlated with people not getting Bitcoin. But nobody's thinking about that now.
And I think even the infrastructure for it, like I'm a big fan of using Wise, and I use that when I'm traveling. But I remember when I used to live here and I had like a Shinsei bank account or a Mitsubishi bank account, and I was like, man, I don't even think you can like get paid from overseas. You know, that's such legacy fiat fucking institutions. You'd have to go and fill out like some paperwork to get some money. I think maybe once I sent some money from New Zealand, I had to go and fill out a form, you know. And so that kind of level of global integration, and I mean, realistically as well, look, Japan's a manufacturing powerhouse. And so it doesn't necessarily, it's a lot different to New Zealand, which is sort of this tiny nation that needs to kind of engage with the world. Japan can kind of just do Japan, right? And there's kind of certain gateways and checkpoints where that interfaces with the world. But for the average sort of person, it's not really a daily thing. I don't know, man. That sort of is where we got to with this other conversation about maybe does that speak to an idea that there's almost kind of a, I don't want to call it an elite class, but sort of a role of corporations or government, perhaps in a Bitcoin future, to kind of be doing that sort of stuff. So, you know, the employees of the company still get paid in the scrip, you know, the yen, but the company itself is selling its cars and its manufactured goods.
Yeah, like the company and the government will protect you from, you know, inflation by themselves investing in Bitcoin or something.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And maybe you speak about paternalism, but I think it's a topic worth exploring because it is, I wouldn't say incompatible with kind of pure outright individual autonomy and capitalism, but it's certainly a different way, a different model.
Yeah, to an extent, I think the paternalism is something that people want. That's why it's here. People rarely say, you know, let's reduce regulations, let's free up the market. Most of the time people are calling for more government intervention here. And people like not having to think about stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's surprising as well. Like you've got sort of government, oh man, it's almost nostalgic, like JA, so Japan Agriculture. I believe that's national, and it's a government organization, right?
It's not technically not government, but it's government adjacent. It's a monopoly on agricultural production, basically.
And I look at that, and I compare that with the situation in New Zealand, where maybe in the 80s you had sort of an export control board or some sort of very uber centralized kind of organization. You still have aspects of that in New Zealand with milk and a couple other industries, but for the most part, agriculture is open, you know, open season, you know, free market. If you want to export apples, you can do it like this or you can do it like that. And there's still regulation, but the actual export isn't handled by some monolithic organization, whereas JA in Japan is literally rice through to milk through to everything is run through one organization with these like offices in every prefecture. And it's sort of like, I don't know, it's like the grand old great society kind of 1950s kind of post-war vision of like how government looks after everything. And it's kind of quaint in 2024 to see that still.
Yeah, it's they even have their own bank. It's one of the biggest banks in the country.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. But then a lot of, you know, you go to the countryside and it's like a core part of the community, and the local JA, you know, bosses and stuff, they would be in all the festivals. They would be in the, you know, New Year's prayer festivals and all, you know, just in the society and the culture of the local town. They'd be quite important people. You'd have to go and talk to them, you know, and to get stuff done, as you mentioned earlier. And you couldn't just turn up and change that.
Yeah, so Japanese agriculture is very labor intensive. So all of the lots are very small, but extremely productive. And so the farmers are kind of very good at doing honest work. They're good at what they do, but not very entrepreneurial. And JA kind of exists to keep them all happy, right? So if competition were more free, eventually there would be some better farmers that expand their lots, that buy up the adjacent farmers' lots, and you might have more mechanization, you might have more like, you know, computer-driven agriculture, right?
Yeah.
But that's not happening, partially because, you know, everyone just wants to do their honest work. I don't know, it's probably not a positive for society as a whole, but for those local communities, that's kind of what they want.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, the reason, I mean, we're talking about agriculture, I mean, I do many things, but one of the things I do is work in agritech in New Zealand and sort of been looking at sort of what's going on over here with innovation and agriculture. And it's sort of strange in a way because it's this sort of, as you say, a very labor intensive. The images of a, you know, literally a kind of field out the back of someone's house, and they've got a, you know, growing rice, you know, and it's an old husband and wife out there. You know, threshing the, you know, planting the seeds and stuff. And it really doesn't speak to scales of economy like you see in other parts mm-hmm. of Asia, where you've got huge farming operations going on. Yet somehow it still works, you know. And I've gotten to the point where I don't doubt what I see if it's sort of somehow succeeding because it's still here. I mean, maybe it's the subsidies that are in there that are making it work, but it's what's been done the whole time and it will continue to be that way. And look, it's just an interesting approach. Like, what does that mean? And coming back, though, to this idea of sort of ways of organizing society, I mean, what I'm excited about more, perhaps more than Bitcoin, actually, is just new ways of being. You know, I think Bitcoin is part of this bigger movement, this kind of reshuffle. And perhaps, you know, we could talk a little bit about what we saw in Japan post-war, some of the land reforms and things, which I think were quite instructive. You saw, you know, this kind of aristocracy pre-war that was sort of the big landowners. So it's sort of, right now we're talking about, well, you know, maybe if it was more entrepreneurial, you would get the farmer buying the neighbor's property. And that was kind of what happened. You had these huge kind of daimyo, kind of feudal plots of land that were owned, and kind of people, you know, sort of
it was more of a serfdom kind of
serfdom
thing. Yeah.
And that, you know, the land reforms post-war, which were very much American led, meant that you could buy a plot and put in an honest day's work, as you say. In a way, you know, that's what we're criticizing here perhaps, but actually in a way that's a lot more preferable to some sort of conglomerate. And again, coming back to Asia, you know, I spent some time in Thailand, and you know, you've got serfdom for days, you know, it's massive corporations running huge farmland. And how does that relate to something like self-sovereignty?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting theme, especially considering the Bitcoin Citadel meme that you see a lot, right? You know, Bitcoin is like, once we make it, we're all going to live, you know, in this community.
This farm in the middle of Japan somewhere.
I don't know how that's going to work out. I feel like it's not, I feel like the ideal, like I understand the community living ideal, and I understand the appeal of, I guess, not having to work for this corporation that you don't necessarily have a interest in succeeding as much as you would have your own little farm. It's definitely something I haven't worked out yet.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one way of looking at it, because the other piece is, I mean, again, a cultural concept here, you know, New Zealand is full of small company, you know, small businesses, and, you know, most, well, not most people, a lot of people either work for the government, the biggest employer, or they work for themselves, work for, you know, a sole trader, you know, like an electrician or a plumber, something like that. Whereas in Japan, you know, you've got the salaryman concept, and that's kind of a meme as well. Mm-hmm. But the idea that, you know, these big corporations kind of take this paternal role and this kind of historical role, which predates a lot of our concepts of sort of corporate structures. Some of these companies go back hundreds of years, you know, and so there's again a historical lineage there that the worker works and the company looks after the worker, and that's kind of, I think, being tested at the moment. But that's again a cultural concept where, I don't know, man, like, how do you decentralize that? These huge companies have scales of economy. They export some of the world's best electronics and vehicles and things. I don't know. I mean, what does that all mean? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there are some things, like heavy industries, I guess, that you just can't decentralize. But I think a lot of change is coming because of the labor shortage in Japan. You know, we've touched on inflation, but wages have been rising lately at a higher pace than they used to be, and a lot of that has to do with the lack of young people, obviously. We've been accepting a lot more foreigners to come and work in the country. I think something like 4 or 5 million, something like that, in the last 3 years or so, which is a pretty significant number. You walk around in Tokyo, you see, you know, non-Japanese heritage people working in all sorts of places. And so things like small farms might not be where you want to like allocate.
I broached this topic. I was out in Nagano a couple of weeks back, and I was in Kobuchizawa, which is a tiny little town, and then I was in Matsumoto for a couple of days, which is a bit bigger kind of regional center. And I was struck by this conversation I had with someone about, you know, there's a lot of Vietnamese workers in Japan, a lot of farm laborers, that sort of thing. And I think, again, there's this sort of cultural context here where deep down, I think there is the idea that these people come and they work and it's an exchange, it's a value for value exchange. But fundamentally, there's a Japanese society and then there's a non-Japanese society. Mm-hmm. And I think you know what I'm talking about. And I think the big difference we see, maybe New Zealand, perhaps, you know, it doesn't quite have that same lineage. And so, you know, eventually people think, well, shit, you know, we'll just buy the farm, you know, and you've got a kind of the system where, you know, there's a pathway to ownership and stake in mm-hmm. what you're doing. And I often think, you know, shit, what is the pathway for some of these laborers? Because there is no pathway, you know, and they work and then they maybe go back eventually to their own country. And I think Vietnam, for example, is a country in its ascendancy. It's kind of moving up, but still it feels quite extractive in both directions. And maybe that equals out. I don't know, though, but I can't help but feel it's sort of like a bit exploitative.
It definitely is. It's a lot of people have been raising this issue for a long time, and you know, it's almost like forced labor camps in some places.
They take the passports away.
Yeah. They pay you like $200 a month or something like that. Yeah. But eventually they won't come. I think that's just how it resolves itself, and you have to improve conditions that they won't come.
Yeah, well, we have a similar situation in New Zealand, you know, with the, you know, apples and kiwi fruit and the export industries, you know, bringing in workers from the Pacific Islands to pick the fruit, and, you know, people on working holidays and things.
Mm.
And, you know, they fly them in. There's obviously labor laws around it, but there's certainly, you know, you have to make a pretty good deal for these guys to leave their families behind to come over and do this work. And I think, you know, a lot of these organizations weren't aware of just how valuable that was. Well, they hadn't, I think they knew, but they weren't really cognizant until COVID, when a lot of these workers couldn't come in. And it was like, holy shit, we just can't get the fruit off the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where mechanization comes in. And, you know, some of these come back to the agri-tech piece. You know, I've been looking at some of the innovation happening in Japan, you know, automated picking machines and things like that. And I mean, I wonder how much of a fix that is. You still need people somewhere in the mix, but I feel like there's innovation that could happen there that could really bridge the gap, at least for a little while.
Definitely.
Laying it out there, I think that there is different way, you know, kind of different configurations of countries, different settings that countries live in, and the way that those countries then interface with Bitcoin, I think, is sort of where I'm going with this. And in particular, Japan, you know, obviously we've got connections here, and I love being here and feel very thankful to be able to come here. But, you know, I see, you know, Bitcoin, it's so hard for people to get their heads around. And I just wonder, man, like, is it just a matter of time?
Maybe. Just waiting for the new generations to roll in.
Do you see young people getting onto Bitcoin in Japan?
They don't seem to be as negative towards it, I guess. I don't speak with that many, but I think their image is mostly formed through social media. And for better or worse, it's not, you know, oh, this is a scam, be careful. It's more like, oh, I got rich, or like, oh, I'm not getting poor, right?
So you say there's this kind of scam kind of attitude, but so you've felt it, because I certainly haven't seen
that. Yeah, it's very prevalent.
I see.
When Diamond Hands held a Lightning Network flea market event, well, we actually had like three stalls at a local flea market in November. A lot of Diamond Hands community members showed up, so it was a big success. We had like over 100 people come, and
It was like a street market, right?
Yeah, there was a street market, and we had like three stalls there, and over 100 people came to our booth, and it was a success. But the locals didn't really like it. Part of it was, you know, there are too many people clogging the street and, you know, making it harder for guests to reach the other stalls. That's a valid criticism, right? But there was clear animosity from a few people towards us, you know, that, oh, yeah, I know what this is all about. You know, you should, if you want to do that kind of stuff, go to Renoir, which is a cafe that's famous for multiware marketing scams, to like make appointments there and recruit new members. So there's definitely a lot of animosity towards that kind of activity, which is completely warranted, obviously, but they kicked us out of the flea market.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's a shame. I mean, that said, I mean, I certainly have noticed in the few years that I've been away, more and more people using online payments. So stuff like PayPay,
mm-hmm.
Line Pay, you know, paying with their smartphone, paying with their smartwatch. Certainly in the old days it was cash or card, or, you know, get the fuck out kind of thing.
Yeah.
But now you've got these other ways of paying, and I think some of the infrastructure and the UX of Lightning Payments means it's obviously designed for payments, and it's super cool. But mm-hmm. we still haven't really seen that many places accepting Lightning. I mean, from a legal perspective, what are the currency rules in terms of being able to accept Bitcoin for goods?
It's difficult if you want to hedge the risk, I suppose. Like, as a business, there's no you don't really need permission to accept Lightning as a payment method. Like, you can accept dollars if you want. Some places near U.S. military bases actually accept dollars, even at chains like McDonald's.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in Misawa and Aomori, there's a famous McDonald's that's dollarized.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But obviously, like, businesses pay their expenses in yen because there's very little you can pay for in Bitcoin at the moment. And to convert Bitcoin to yen, you need a very hard to get exchange license. It's expensive to keep. There's a lot of compliance. You need a bunch of staff and probably like half to $1 million a year to basically keep the license. So we need the exchanges to be on board with like accepting Lightning payments on behalf of businesses so that they can sell their Bitcoin if they want to do that. But Japanese exchanges are not very concerned with integrating Lightning at the moment. Their main business is obviously selling shitcoins. So
that's an interesting perspective, because I lament in New Zealand, we struggle. It's very hard to get a bank account for a Bitcoin business. But what you're talking about is, you know, you need lawyers and millions of dollars to be able to do that in Japan.
If you want to exchange Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency among each other or for cash, you need...
But even like a fiat ramp.
Yes.
You'd need all of that stuff.
If it's a business, technically, you need all this like massive compliance infrastructure. Yeah.
And so I guess in a way I can be a bit thankful that it's not that bad in New Zealand. Yeah. Like, you know, as I said, a couple of guys with a startup are able to do it at level.
And a lot of it is the result of the many failures Japanese crypto exchanges have had over the years.
There's a few famous ones.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And so what does that mean though for innovation in the space? I mean, you're obviously... Diamond Hands are working on some cool stuff. There is a number of cool, innovative Bitcoin companies out here. Mempools.space is based in Tokyo, right? Is there any others that are sort of notable?
BTC Pay Server. It's not a business, I guess, but it's based in Tokyo.
Open source project, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. So there's a few projects going on, but it seems like they are focusing more on some of the tech as opposed to sort of direct services.
Anything that involves exchange of tokens or custody of tokens is just too difficult here.
Yeah.
There's no point in starting it here. Just operate overseas and service Japanese customers illegally is kind of the standard, I guess.
Is that like the Binance model that you mean?
The Binance model, basically. I mean, even things like Wallet of Satoshi are technically illegal.
Oh, really?
Not to use, but to provide in Japan.
If you want to use, say, through something like Wallet of Satoshi, I believe it's like MoonPay. They have like for buying Bitcoin with a credit card. That works.
That's technically not okay, but you know, we use it anyway. So.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you've got there's a technical skill set within Japan, and certainly my experience working here, there's tech companies, a lot of really talented engineers and stuff. My general impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like there's a lot of stuff happening, like layer 2 sort of development, Lightning Games, you know, our mutual friend Tanaka-san working on, you know, some Lightning stuff. I feel like a lot more of that than you would see in other places. You know, basically a lot of really good engineers and software people here, but maybe hamstrung by the ability to actually stand up proper businesses because of their sort of access to banking services.
Yes, absolutely. And we've been complaining about this for quite a long time now, but the shitcoiners have a bigger say. And so even recently, they made some small amendments to, I think, the tax code. But the amendment is literally like, you know, you don't get taxed on unrealized gains on tokens that you issued yourself or something like that. And this applies to how many people, right?
Yeah.
How many businesses? Okay.
Interesting. And so you say, you know, you're trying to bring this topic up, but I mean, realistically, what are the methods and what are the, I mean, how do you even begin to talk about this? Because I mean, the Japanese government is notably one of these sort of slow moving behemoths. I mean, have you had any traction talking with officials or... And when I say you, as in, you know, you guys?
Like. Well, I know that we've briefed some congressmen, I guess, on the matter, but they're not, you know, they're not really interested.
They just want to do an honest day's work.
they have other things on their mind.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I see. What do you think's the pathway? Just sort of, I guess, wrapping up, looking forward to the year. I mean, what are you excited about, Kishin? What do you think the pathways are for Japan and Bitcoin sort of longer term?
I feel like all of this regulation stuff is going to take a long time to work out, but I'm actually kind of optimistic that for things that are non-custodial and peer-to-peer, I guess the regulations don't technically apply. Like, if you're not a service provider that's taking custody of people's coins or, you know, exchanging them for fiat, if you're just doing that on a personal level, you know, it's okay. So as Lightning matures, as other layer twos on Bitcoin come up, and the more things you can do non-custodially, it will matter a lot less, the regulations. So I'm optimistic that eventually the technical talent will find ways to not be encumbered by.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like, you know, having to have half a million just to start up a business, you know, it's insane, and it's sort of stifling, you know. And I mean, Japan has a lot of other things that it's very good at, you know, but it's almost like, man, there's an opportunity. And I mean, maybe it is, you know, some of these open source projects, decentralized projects, non-custodial services, things like that. I mean, maybe that's the future, and it kind of almost sidesteps the need to kind of go through the paperwork. Mm. I certainly feel that maybe over the last few years, you know, I've really felt, you know, with the rise in remote work, you know, being able to incorporate companies overseas and somewhere like New Zealand, where it's actually a little bit easier quite a lot easier. I don't know, that was always a thing, but I think it's certainly accelerated. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that's sort of what we look at, and eventually, yeah, maybe, you know, in some decades, the government sort of works it all out, but you can't let that guide you, because you'll always be putting the cart before the horse, right?
Absolutely. You're going to be years behind.
Yeah. And I mean, the other big thing is looking at mining and hardware, because, you know, obviously Japan, you know, vehicles, electronics, all of this stuff, yet we don't see, well, I mean, I'm not aware of any Japanese ASIC manufacturing or hardware. Do you know if there's anything in that space that's happening?
Not that I know of, no.
I mean, because I think hardware, I mean, that's another big space where it's very much centralized in China right now. And certainly Japan, Taiwan, different parts of Asia have the expertise, the skills to develop these things, but we just don't see commercial.
Yeah, TSMC, the Taiwanese semiconductor company, is expanding its production in Japan.
I see.
I think it's geopolitical de-risking, I think.
Have they got a fab out here, or...?
So they're building a huge fab in Kumamoto over in Kyushu. And I think they announced plans recently to open one in Osaka as well. So there is kind of a influx of semiconductor industry, and maybe that'll bring some interest in developing Bitcoin miners as well.
I have a feeling, I mean, man, that would be beautiful. You know, low energy, high efficiency ASIC miners, Japan made. De-risking the Chinese manufacturers as we come into these kind of turbulent years. It's exciting times, man. But hey, I really appreciate your thoughts and your insight. We've just sort of spitballed a few different things, but it's important to have these conversations and just kind of explore the space and kind of uncover what we need to look at next. Is there anything else you'd want to add, or how can people find out about what you're writing, what you're working on, Kishin?
So a lot of my work is in Japanese, but I do a podcast with a Koji from Diamond Hands and another guy, Joe, called Bitcoin Hansekai on YouTube. I also write for Bitcoin Kenkyujo, which is kind of paid technical newsletter, I guess. I actually, a few years ago, I made a Lightning Network auction protocol called Paddle, but you shouldn't use it because I haven't been maintaining it. I'll probably figure something out.
One last question. Have you had anyone come to you in terms of news outlets, media, in terms of like getting a Bitcoin take, or like who do they go to when they want to find out about Bitcoin in Japan?
Occasionally, actually, yeah. But not like mainstream media. I don't know who they
who does Kyodo Shimbun or NHK go to if they want to talk about Bitcoin?
I guess one of the big exchanges, like Bitflyer, I think.
Yeah.
They probably ask some higher ups there for their opinion.
For an honest day's work. Okay. Yeah. Nah, well, that's good, mate. Well, hey, Kishan, I really appreciate it. And thanks for organizing the space for this show. No, thank you. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.